The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Professor Heidi Matthews researches and teaches in the areas of international criminal law, the law of war, international legal history, and political theory. She is an assistant professor at Osgoode Hall Law School, and recently she wrote an essay for Aeon Magazine entitled, How Do We Understand Sexual Pleasure in This Age of Consent? And this essay is the topic of the conversation in this week's podcast. It's late on Thursday, April 5th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to thank J.H., Michael T., Robert B., and 243 other patrons of the Inside Zero Books podcast. You're making Zero Books digital content production possible. I also want to remind listeners that if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to become a patron as well. Patrons sometimes hear the second half of conversations featured on the Zero Books podcast, and sometimes gain access to episodes on topics such as Bordiga, Struggle Sessions, James Baldwin, Value Theory, Blade Runner, and so on and so on. If you haven't already, you might get a hold of Angela Nagle's Kill All Normies, or check out Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism. The music you're listening to right now is Activity and Scales by The Focus Group. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Heidi Matthews discuss consent and the erotic. Heidi Matthews is an assistant professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School at York University in Canada. She lives in Toronto. She is also a writer, and her essay, How Do We Understand Sexual Pleasure in This Age of Consent, was recently published in Aeon Magazine. So, Heidi, thank you for coming onto the Zero Books podcast to talk about your essay and to talk about sexual consent.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.
So, I guess the first thing I should ask you is, what has the reaction been to the publication of this essay? Because I haven't followed that, and I'm curious to know if you got away, you know, scot-free on this one.
I'm not sure I was trying to get away with anything, but just sort
of. Well, I know you're not, but it's just in this moment to raise this kind of issue or this kind of question seems like it would bring a response.
Yeah. No, obviously, it's an incredibly provocative topic, and I think my approach in and of itself is intentionally provocative, right? But that's kind of the way that I teach and that I also like to write. So it's interesting. I guess it depends on like where you look, right? for a reaction. I mean, among my sort of scholarly community and people involved in thinking critically and from an explicitly progressive and or left position about these issues, I think the reaction's really been overwhelmingly positive. People are teaching it to their law school classes, which is fantastic. But then if you look at, you know, Twitter, it can be a different story. So I have been called a rape apologist, but, you know, that's a lack of understanding. So that I can roll with that.
You were prepared for those kinds of accusations to be hurled your way, and this particular historical moment, being called those kinds of names, doesn't sting as much as it might have 5 or 6 years ago? Or
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it's like, I know that this might be a bit of a cliche, but, you know, the idea that you're really only doing or thinking productively if you're pissing people off, I kind of do take to heart. And that's kind of, to one degree or another, has always been the case with, I think, most of my work, but in particular, work that I've been doing around sexuality in wartime, you know, since I was a graduate student. So this is not particularly new or difficult.
Well, normally when I read critiques of Me Too, of the Me Too movement, and I'm not sure if that's even a fair characterization of what you're...
Yeah, I would resist that characterization,
yeah,
but go ahead.
Yeah, when I read critiques of, say, affirmative consent, to be more specific, as the standard for consent, I hear people talk about how inadvertently that standard might be disempowering to women. It's mostly coming from people who make the charge that the climate now is coddling to women, or that we're failing to recognize women's agency. But
yeah,
your essay doesn't really land there. You are asking a different question. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a more provocative one, for a number of reasons, because it cuts against a sort of puritanical streak, which is in the background of all of our talk about this. You emphasize the question of sexual pleasure and what the standard of affirmative consent is doing to that. So why did you choose to focus on sexual pleasure rather than empowerment of women in this?
So I don't think those two things can be usefully disaggregated, first.
Okay.
So to point out, I think you're right. The typical affirmative consent resistors don't need to at all take the direction that that I've taken. And so you can, you know, one could take the position that consent in some iteration is still a valuable way about thinking through how we regulate sex legally and also socially, right? Insofar as law and society are co-produced, though there's been a lot of resistance in the discourse to that thought as well. But just to bracket that, you know, you can be very committed to like a big L liberal conception of freedom and, you know, how the state and its laws are meant to produce freedom through, you know, standard, basically contract law ideas that consent draws on. And that's, you know, and so those people don't like the idea of affirmative consent because it really puts a very high burden in general. There are different ways of talking or, you know, articulating an affirmative consent standard, but in general, it would really heighten the burden on an accused in a criminal situation in terms of what they would have to do to be acquitted of a charge of sexual assault. But yeah, for me, that criticism is it's common and it's a lot less interesting. And I don't consider myself a liberal. And so I'm not interested in that line of political reasoning. I'm much more interested in, you know, emancipatory projects. I think we probably share that. And I, you know, for my part, it's the real danger. Well, there are many, but one of the real dangers in the tone and content of the present discourse is the way in which it really encourages us to abstract our thinking away from the interrelationship of pleasure to freedom to emancipation and to, as you mentioned, women's agency.
You don't merely go after affirmative consent. In your essay, you write, "The idea that consent to sexual activity should be the benchmark for deciding what constitutes legally permissible and socially desirable sex is far from obvious." Now, that seems to me to be a truly provocative statement. Most people that I know would say that that's sort of it is obvious that it's like the minimal requirement, the lowest rung on the ladder that leads towards good sex and the emancipation of women and even to the emancipation of women's sexuality. I know your whole essay is like spelling out how you disagree with this, but
is only 1,300 words, right. So it's really a template for obviously a much larger project.
Right. So how is it that the idea of consent could be abandoned, and what other sorts of ideas would we want to bring forward to be the basis of freedom and yeah, I'm going to say a free sexual encounter.
Right. I mean, again, all of that really comes down to how we conceptualize freedom, right? as you know, so there are that is just, begging the question over again. And I think, that points us to the way in which consent is a really troubled historically and in the context of the present concept, in the sense that there's never, there's no agreed upon definition. Consent has always historically been a fraught and indeterminate concept. That's true of all legal concepts, that they're indeterminate, right? So they were only approximations of both reality and how we want to organize reality in terms of legal and social regulation. So that shouldn't actually be particularly controversial. But the second point is that consent in particular, with respect to anything in basic contract law or in any area of social life, is a difficult subject, particularly fraught in sexuality, when we're dealing with sexuality. And in that realm, ideas about what consent to sex means are, really at the front of legal debates, both within the U.S. and also globally, right? So there's no agreed upon definition of consent to sex, even among those who are committed to the idea of consent. So we can start to unpack what consent means to us or you or whatever, right? I mean, I ask my students that. So, you can start a discussion about sexual assault by being, so what does consent mean to you? And what you'll find is it means incredibly different things to different people.
Yeah. Well, so what are some of the definitions that people throw around in the legal context? I mean, I kind of like to pretend anyway that if I were in a court of law that my lawyer would know what consent was, or at least that there would be an operative definition, and that the judge would, or the jury would be told. And so.
Sure. Yeah. So when I say there's no agreed upon definition, so I'm not saying that that there's no certain quote unquote certainty in the law, right? the fiction of the rule of law, persists. But so yes, of course, every jurisdiction, is operating with a set of laws. But you can take America from when I talk about lack of agreement. Criminal law in the United States especially with regard to sexual matters, by and large, regulated by the states, as you know, right? Mm-hmm. So each state can have massively different approaches to this question. On the contrary, in Canada, where I now live and work, we have a federal criminal law system. And so just to give you an example, in the Canadian Criminal Code, consent means, quote, the voluntary agreement of the complainant to engage in the sexual activity in question, end quote. And then there are a series of addendums to that provision that describe situations where the law will deem consent to be not present, right? So whether or not, and so this means that whether or not the complainant in a particular case thinks they've consented, the law will decide that they haven't, and that there are several situations. One is where a complainant is incapable of consenting, and then we can talk about what incapable means. But sort of by maybe extreme intoxication might be an example,
or being like mentally incapacitated or in a abused state.
Yes.
Well, okay. Now I want to go on a diversion here. I want to divert our conversation away from sex and talk just about law for a moment, because
we should do that.
And what's popped in my mind is this memory. I love telling these little. I'm getting older now, so I tell these little stories from my childhood from time to time. It's really pathetic. but I remember being at summer camp, and we were all sitting around. I was maybe 11 or 12 years old, and we were really trying to rack our brains as to how to determine what's true. Like, we were little mini philosophers sitting around in our tent. And this assistant counselor, maybe 17 years old, just thought he was really smart because he said, you know, you're debating when you don't need to debate. What's true is what's determined in the courts of law.
And poor bloke.
And that is the end of the matter. It's been, the consensus has been found. The courts have made a judgment. And that is what is true.
So, all I'm saying is 24.
What about 24?
That's it. That's the highest number.
24?
That's it. Where are you going to go from there?
Yeah, 24, forget about it.
That's Van Gogh. What about 18?
Yeah, 18. Now, that's the biggest number.
No, 24 is the highest number. Look, you got 10, then you got 10 more, then it's like, what's this, 4 more? 24, forget about it.
Yeah, but 18.
Look, count with me here, right? Okay, you got 1, right?
Right.
Okay, then you got 2, right? Yeah. Then there's 3, right. Okay? Yeah. Over here comes 4.
Shut up! Quit your counting! You bunch of cacholis! I'm trying to read the damn racing form here. 24 is the highest number, and that's it. Let it go.
Sorry, boss.
Yeah, sorry.
I am sorry, Don Corelli, that I said 18.
Even though I was skeptical at the time, and of course remain skeptical about whether or not that would satisfy me as a definition of truth with a capital T, I later came to kind of believe that a good enough truth was established in courts of law. That good enough truth was extremely important in terms of maintaining social order. I mean, if you're into that kind of thing, but also it also in having some sort of way to equalize power relationships between people who are unequal in reality. Right. So, in other words, we're all equal in front of the law. Right. There's a process that's set up to determine the truth.
All of us, including corporations, as legal.
Right, including corporations. I mean, I would have a much better shot at doing something about what a corporation was doing in a court of law than I would most of the place.
Unless they're deemed to have, the ability to contribute without any limitations to campaign funds.
Well, the laws can be altered, but at least there would be a process. Otherwise, what am I going to do to try to stop a corporation? So despite the fact that I, am a Marxist and want to see a different kind of society in this one.
So is it the form or the substance that you're romanticizing?
See, that's a loaded question.
I think that's really important.
Okay.
I think that's
which one am I attached to is how I would put it.
Yeah.
Romanticizing. I think that I think it's the form, the process, the having an institution where at least an attempt is made for there to be some sort of equitable accounting of and fair accounting of a crime or of some sort of wrong, and where a judgment can be made with some consistent standards rather than based on the slippery kinds of standards, which I experience far too often on online, for instance, on Twitter,
yeah.
or in most everyday discourse, where a number of factors that have nothing to do with what I'll call reason interfere and intervene in determining outcomes. I mean, what is your position in regards to the
untruth in law?
Truth in law.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are a number of ways of going about this. I mean, I think it's fairly uncontested, unless it's true, unless you're an anarchist, which I'm not in general. It's true that one should want to put in place a series of state-backed institutions that organize themselves around principal thought, and also a series of commitments to basic social values. It's pretty unobjectionable that we would want to have state-backed social institutions that promote principled thought and a series of commitments to basic social values, right? But you can't talk about process as distinct from those values and how they become articulated in concrete institutional and substantive legal terms, right? Because as a scholar of war, I object always when people will turn easily to the Nazi example, but it's actually opposite here. Because, you know, you can have a very, fascist and unjust, but very consistent, legal system, right?
Yeah.
It's totally possible and happens all the time.
So trials are no better than no trials is what you're getting at here. It's like if you have
absolutely. And all of that is to point out that, you know, attachment to legal institutions can't be divorced from the substance that's pursued in them, right? So then we're forced to turn to the substance, is my point.
Right.
Which is great. We should turn to the substance. But I work in a tradition broadly understood as critical legal studies, right? So people applying either Marxist or post-structuralist approaches to critique and law and organizing that within how we think about society in general. And, you know, it's clear that there are many, many problems with, as we know, liberalism and its neoliberal instantiation, and law is not separate from those, right? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the rule of law or any variety of basic rights, none of those things are, you know, we can't promote these ideas as though they are simply goods on the face of it, right? That are not subject to critique. And so the basic idea about legal indeterminacy is that you can use the idea of a basic right to whatever, I don't know, liberty and security, whatever. And the question is, how do you play that out? That could mean a variety of things politically. It could lead to a variety of decisions that we find to be on the right of the political spectrum or on the left. And the content is not determined by the norm itself or the value itself. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, clarify that a little bit. So if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is, while we may have a social value that we agree to, how we try to implement laws to protect that social value can have either a right wing or a left wing character, and that we have to be critical of how we implement law in order to protect what are maybe widely held, if not universal, social norms.
Right. And so it's just, you know, we can talk about universalism all we want, but the idea is that in order to get there, you've got to water down the content of the basic norms to such a degree that they only make sense, that they can play out on both sides of the political spectrum, right? And that's fine. That might be the basic reality of law. I mean, many people devote their lives to philosophizing about law, what makes law, does law have to, you know, there's a long debate over what actually makes law, and whether it's simply a social fact or whether it actually reflects substantive morality, right? This is a big tradition in the field, and those are interesting debates. But I'm a little bit more interested in, firstly, you know, working from the premise that law is indeterminate, that's fine. We don't need to, in order to feel safe moving around the law and using legal language, we don't need to be committed to some fanciful idea about its relationship to truth or reality, for example.
Right. Okay. So now I still am stuck here with trying to figure out how to have a good, you know, court system, say, or a good legal judgment Because if we don't have, if we can't rely on, say, the laws being written well and simply implemented, and because they're really not universal truths. In other words, every situation is so overdetermined that you're not going to be sure which law really applies until you've evaluated the crime or the scene. Or so what, well, is that why we need to have, you know, virtuous men and women sitting in judgment? Is that why, you know?
Well, I think we need to, I don't know about, I mean, so Ronald Dworkin had a, the late Ronald Dworkin had a whole theory about the judge as Hercules, right? And so, and he's a big liberal legal thinker, right? And so very committed to the idea that actually we're all fallible and whatever, but we're basically doing the best we can. And a judge as Hercules is going to find an interpretation of the law in its relationship to the facts in a particular situation that's going to have the highest level of integrity possible.
Right.
And so it's going to come the closest to approximating the truth, right? I mean, I just don't really buy that as a useful way of thinking through decision making and also legal argumentation. I think what's much more important if you're committed to a left praxis in this area, what we need to do is to be making a sort of concrete cost benefit really analysis of who wins and who loses, like what the material distributive consequences are of the way that laws work in society. And that analysis goes a lot farther and a lot deeper than simply asking how a judge decides a certain case or what the best legal argument might be, although those things obviously come into play.
So you have a utilitarian approach to the law.
No. I mean, in a sense, I don't really care. Like, I know that you like to have these discussions about, you know.
I'm big into – well, you tipped your hand and said you were on Thaddeus' side, so – I'm just recreating my fight with Thaddeus here.
I know. I was on Team Thaddeus for sure. But I don't care. You can call me a utilitarian. It's cool.
Okay. All right. But no, okay. But so that's – I don't necessarily have to agree or disagree with you on that, because the truth of – and I think that this is at least my position. The truth of how to approach ethical systems or ethical – quandaries is really still being worked out, and people do end up in different camps and at different times. And so if you know, it's a really easy game to just pin a label on someone and say, oh, you're a utilitarian, because as soon as you do that, you're putting a definition on someone which has already been refuted. I mean, any one of these, if you're a virtue ethicist or a Kantian universalist or a utilitarian, we all have like a whole like 101 textbooks which have refutations of these positions. So it's not really fair to you to try to pin you down like that.
No. And I also just don't think it really answers any of the questions that I'm interested in asking.
I know. But it was a fun game for me. So, all right. But let's go back to these questions that are actually in your text.
Sure.
So the question here is about how do we preserve, and I'm going to put this in sort of in a utilitarian frame. How do we preserve a culture and a climate in which sexual pleasure is still on the table for most people, and the we haven't defined what makes good sex and appropriate and socially acceptable sex so strictly that now we're unintentionally more than putting a damper on a romantic evening, but really hurting the climate for our whole culture. Is that a fair way to?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's my worry. You know, I don't want to be I'm trying to work through a social phenomenon that we're like living in the midst of. Right. So I have a series of intuitions about what's going on, why it's going on, why certain actors are behaving in certain ways and what the likely repercussions are. But, you know, all of that's obviously open to constant recalibration. But yes, in general, that's right.
So one of the things you say is that in your essay, and this was one that I agree with, but that I wouldn't normally speak about too much in public, is that you consider,
That's okay. I'll do it.
Do you think that women's sexuality is generally more ambiguous than male sexuality? And I
no, so I didn't say that
you didn't.
In particular.
Okay, what?
No, so what I said was women's. So I'm just reading from my own piece now. But so women's sexual pleasure is often viewed as more complicated and less predictable, and that historically that assumption has contributed to overregulation of female sexual and reproductive capacity. Oh, so that was what I said.
Great.
So I don't actually
now I've admitted
that.
To being a Neanderthal more than you are. So because I kind of believe that. but
so I don't ascribe to that statement. I think that idea that goes along with historical assumptions about women's vulnerability in sex, mm-hmm. right? That also contribute to the idea that regulation is based around protecting women from sexual harm on the idea that women are more likely to suffer sexual-based harms than other sorts of harms, for example, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure I quite follow the logic, just because if your sexuality or your sexual pleasure is more complicated, that makes it necessarily more vulnerable or in need of protection.
Well, which that's not what I'm saying, yeah. That the one necessarily follows from the other. I was just trying to talk about a series of historical views about women's sexuality. But I think what you're right, that claim would be difficult and take a lot more work and time than we have the space to do right now to parse. Mm-hmm. But what I think is less difficult and more intuitively graspable mm-hmm. is the idea that male sexuality is more predictable and simpler, right?
Right. And along with that is it is kind of brutish and
exactly.
and object oriented and really it needs to be contained.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think if we flip it and talk about it in that way, I think the point is maybe a little bit clearer.
And so you're doubting that, and you what you want to argue is that these ways of thinking about sexuality once you're in a moment, once you're actually in the world, they don't really apply and they're not that helpful. And is that kind of what you mean? What do you mean when you say sexual liminality?
A few years ago, a philosopher friend of mine shared with me the concept of liminal space. It's provocative to me and intriguing. You think about this. It's the space between two points of existence. It's the space between a relationship that ends and a relationship that begins. It's the space between a job lost and a job obtained. It's that gap between things in our life. And most of us cannot exist in liminal space. We rush through liminal space. Oh, I lost my job or the relationship didn't work out, and all of a sudden you want another relationship to replace the relationship because you can't live in liminal space. You can't live without something. The sad part of that is, and the failure part of that is liminal space is a gift. You think about this. If I lost my job, maybe liminal space is the time to get to know myself so that I understand what kind of job I should have. If the relationship ends, maybe liminal space is an opportunity to transform, to become the person you were meant to be so that the next relationship becomes more fuller, more relational, more beneficial and joyful. Liminal space, the space between.
Yeah. So this is really, so again, this is where I say like, this is a very much a long work in project in progress, right? And this is the core sort of theoretical space that I'm trying to work through, right? But of course, the liminal has to do with, in a sense, ambiguity, right? Or the idea of the threshold, or something that's difficult to grasp, or sort of you know, a space that's difficult to ascertain. And the reason why I think it's really important to focus on that in part is because once we do so, it's a way of working through why sex consent as a concept is potentially unhelpful and destructive. Because, I mean, not to talk about reality as such, but I think it reflects people's experiences, right? So all of us have, I think we can share in the intuition that our lived experiences of sex are very difficult to put into legal and increasingly social boxes using language like consent. So because that's sort of the most common box that's trying to be put around sexuality.
Right. I mean, and what I'd point out is, and maybe add here, is that even the most vanilla encounters can have a whole freight load of ambiguity and extra meanings around them, so that it's not always clear. I mean, I'm in a long-term marriage. I've been married for over 20 years, and I will tell you that
I'm so sorry.
Oh, well, I won't respond to that. But what I'll say is, just having that long of a history means that every encounter, you know, is a field, you know, it's like a field full of landmines. Not so much, it's just that, you know, comparisons to like, okay, how does this relate to that one time in 1995 or, you know, just that kind of thing. So, it's not always simple what's going on, even when it's a, you know, otherwise very heteronormative encounter.
Right.
So I'm not exactly sure why I'm talking about this, but I will say that
I think it's not, you know, we do need to, I don't think there's anything wrong. I do resist the idea that, you know, careful thought is at odds with thinking through our own experiences here. I mean, obviously we need to be careful about it, but I think that's
right.
Completely.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that once you start to cross-examine any sexual encounter, it would be possible to put it into the worst light. You know, it's always a somewhat animalistic encounter. There's always inequalities of power, whether they shift around. And it's so none of it is simple and straightforward and clean the way that we like to think a contract is, for example.
Right. I mean, so then you need to look at like the value. So part of what I want to do is to interrogate the values that we think we're promoting when we talk about different ways in which sex should be regulated, like the concepts we're using. And I, in this piece, am focusing on consent as one of those, right? So what ideas about the meaning of pleasure and sex are we intentionally or not promoting when we're focused on consent, right? As a way of organizing our thought. And I think, like you said, like the idea that the basic idea that unequal bargaining power is a bad thing, normatively speaking, is completely, in my mind, preposterous in a sexual encounter, oftentimes where part of the sensuality or eroticism and hence social meaning of the thing is predicated on exactly or that sort of inequality.
Right. Right. And okay, so now I'm going to ask you this next question on my list, which is about Robin West, because I feel like maybe her distinction between wanted and consensual cuts against, I mean, I'm not sure if it cuts against this notion that we need pure, like true equality in terms of bargaining power in order to have a successfully.
No, it does cut against it. So she's against consent.
Right. All right. So,
But for very different political reasons than I am.
Okay. So, so that's right.
I think so, that's what I would consider.
So, what is the difference between wanted and consensual sex, according to Robin West? And then what is your approach, maybe to the same terms, or maybe what's your new set of terms?
When one is critiquing a set of legal technologies, one often gets the reactionary or knee-jerk response, well, what do you have that's better to offer? So that's a response I've gotten a lot.
Yeah.
To peace and to other things that I've said in public or written. Well, you must, you know, we can't engage in a thoroughgoing critique. It's not responsible, let's say, or helpful to the public discourse, or the scholarly discourse for that matter, to engage in an intense debate with respect to this concept, unless you're willing to come on the other side with a prepackaged, shiny new concept.
Right. I mean, okay. So I'm going to grant you that, right? That you don't have to.
And I think that's preposterous as well.
Yeah. It cuts against my Hegelianism to say that you have to start with your you know, knowledge at the beginning.
Well, I just resist that in order to be taken seriously, I need to like fix it all today.
Yeah.
That's irresponsible in my mind, profoundly irresponsible. So just to put that on the table, because that is like a common response. And often, you know, that's a very, especially for law students or people working in law, the tendency is always to, you know, do a little critique, but then say, I've got a law reform project.
Yeah.
And I just resist that. I don't think that's helpful.
Okay.
So that's the first thing I would say to that. In terms of the distinction, So what West but others like her are doing, they're saying, look, we've known for and she's been and others have been saying this for like many, many years, right? Like, it's just what's beautiful in a way about this sort of so-called Me Too movement is that these things are actually like now sayable publicly, which is great. So that's the only positive thing that I can see coming from this movie. That being said, she and others, right? So in the coercive sex universe, the idea is that the wrongfulness or like the social harm that they're trying to get at is not the same social harm that the consent based will think that they're trying to get at. And so in other words, well, you can have consensual sex that is also not particularly wanted. And I think this happens. So to bring back your marriage discussion. But I mean, you know, you can imagine like you're tired, and this is like what happens. I should say, I don't think that this happens particularly to women either. I just want to throw that out there, that the, you know, this happens to men as well. But I think there are lots of situations, right, where you can imagine that you're like tired and you've been with your kid all, whatever people do with their kids all day, and they, you know, and you don't want to, but your partner really does. And so you go along, you sort of go along with it for the sake of peace or whatever. And you can't say that's not consensual because you've willingly engaged in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's certainly desired.
Right.
And so that captures a whole host of sexual activity, right? So consent, that's just one example in which the consent framework really doesn't help us. And they want to talk about harm being located in sort of broader subordination structures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, there are different approaches to this, but if you can construe based on a host of contextual factors that a situation has been coerced in some way, then that's what we should be talking about. But I think that's much more, I mean, I'm sure that they think that's progressive, but I think that that's much more dangerous than even the affirmative consent paradigm.
First of all, okay, I'm going to just say getting what you want is, for me anyway, I find that when I get what I really think I want, it's not always the best thing. For instance,
yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know if I'd really want to hold that standard as the most ethical, or, you know, like sometimes it's good to make accommodations in life. I'm not saying that, you know, that sounds very Neanderthal when it's applied by a husband, you know, to his wife. But on the other hand, it's not.
I don't think it does.
It's not Neanderthal in other contexts. Like, you know.
Yeah.
There are blueberry muffins on the table. I ate one yesterday when I ought not to have, you know, I wanted it, but I didn't need it. And if I had really thought about it, if I should have consented to my better nature and not had it. And so that's just a really dumb example, but I think trying to privilege, this level of desire seems wrongheaded to me, and not just because it could lead to draconian situations in courts or sets a standard that's impossible to really define and understand, but also it just isn't the right social value, That's that would be my critique of that. But on the other hand, it is interesting to see that it's possible to doubt consent as the ultimate standard. And I guess that's what—
Totally. Yeah. I mean, even conservative feminists like Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin and others they've always recognized that, you know, consent is just like, it's a fiction. It's a legal fiction. You know, it doesn't, and they do so in part because they think that, the sexualized domination of women is so pervasive in society that women can barely consent to anything.
Right.
Right. You know, but a simple way of thinking about what I'm interested in or this project, right, is trying to have a much more thoroughgoing articulation of what thinking against consent from an explicitly left, very sex, for lack of a better term, sex positive positionality actually looks like. Because there's a lot of thinking against consent. So just to say, right, to make people aware, there is a lot of thinking against consent. It's not like this is new, but it's from directions that are, I think, problematic.
Right. Yeah. The directions that you don't agree with.
That have, I think, bad substantive outcomes.
Right. Right. So now I think the most troubling or problematic move you make in your essay, and it's not one that I say that it's troubling or problematic because I think it's abominable or it should be rejected, but just because I was troubled and found it problematic.
That's fine. I'm glad.
It was when you censured and privileged the erotic over other values, such as autonomy and purity, which I think are—
I was interested. Like, what's purity?
Yeah, okay. Well, purity would be, I guess purity would be when you are getting what you want, when that clean, pure moment of pure equality between two consenting adults, and you've worked it all out and the contract is signed.
Right.
That's a pure moment. Not like, you know, maybe what you've agreed to is incredibly dirty. You could have agreed, like, consented to ping in each other's mouths or whatever, but as long as that, as long as you've signed on
the first
line,
time I've heard you say that.
Well, my inner Zizek is coming out at this moment.
It's like, I see.
I know a much more dirty version of the jokes on aristocrats than I've seen the film, the one there. I would call it, even by nastier name, the perverts. I mean, imagine the same situation. The group, the family, comes to the manager of a seedy, hardcore nightclub and tell, we have a really dirty, dirty performance. And the guy asks them, okay, do it for me. And then they start to perform. What? The son refers to Hegel's phenomenology, the consciousness. Mother said, no, you forgot about the logic of essence. Father said, what about absolute knowing? They go on, and finally the manager explodes. What's the title of this? The perverts. Yes, all the fist-fucking, eating shit in aristocrats, it's nothing compared in perverse, obscene power than to one good piece of Hegelian dialectics. You have to accept this today. We need this attitude. We theorists are true big criminals, are the true perverts. All these people who do sadism, shit-eating, whatever, they are modest conservatives. Thanks very much.
So, you can consent. It doesn't have to be pure, like as a driven snow in fact, but it's pure because the autonomy and equality is preserved. And but you privileged the erotic, which to me is I don't know. I know what the erotic is, but I would have a very difficult time to define it, you know, especially in a court of law. Like, this, does this count as erotic?
Right.
So go. I'll let you talk now.
This is great. Yeah. So I would just adjust, like, tweak that slightly to say that it's not so much that I, like, with unreservedly privilege the erotic, whatever that means, right? So wholly recognizing that this is also a category that's expansive and needs to be thought about deeply. Okay, whatever. But what I want to do is I want to put it on the table in the sense that I don't think the left should be, like, giving the terrain of sex and the erotic to the right. or even to the liberals, mm-hmm. right? Like giving away this, we're saying just take it. Because nobody wants to do, nobody wants to say, I think, things like I've said or whatever. I don't know. That's my thought. But the idea, so I'm not so much privileging the erotic, although maybe I will in the end. And I think it's extremely important, obviously, from the piece. But I'm trying to say we need to put it on the table as like the really deserving focus for political and intellectual attention and analysis. And what that means is to say that the erotic potential that I talk about in the piece does need to be given a seat at the table, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense that like that's a factor that needs to be taken into consideration, and that the typical response to that is to say something like, well, consent is sexy. And I got this a lot on Twitter, for example, like, haven't you heard of BDSM? And BDSM is totally predicated on everybody talking about everything up front and consenting and whatever. And I said, well, I think that those people are not, I mean, not that I'm necessarily some sort of expert on BDSM, but I'm not sure that's a fair characterization either. But that being said, the idea is, and this is partly where the liminality comes back into it, there is really socially worthwhile, so not just individually, but really socially worthwhile meaning that's produced in encounters that are not necessarily easily translatable or articulatable within the legal and social categories that we want to privilege, like autonomy or freedom or purity, like you, whatever that means that you mentioned. So, you know, and this goes back to your point just now when you said, look, you were basically acknowledging what I said in the piece, like we don't always know what we quote unquote want.
You know what I'm trying to do here? Not the disgusting thing of claiming, oh, so those machos are right, women sometimes really want it. I claim that if you dream about something intimately, the most terrifying thing that can happen to you is to get it in reality. This is the complicity of your fantasy that is aroused by it. This makes the pain unbearable.
What I like about what you're saying is that you're being honest. You're saying, I am not trying to make a correction here. I'm not actually trying to come up with a new approach here. I'm critiquing. And I'm trying to open up a space for people to think about what's actually happening. And this is what I've got to offer, these critiques. Pick them up. Do something with them.
Totally. I mean, you can't even begin to responsibly think through, and responsibly from a political perspective, right? And from a strategic and tactical perspective. Like, you can't even begin to think through what that would look like until you do a really honest confrontation from a critical standpoint.
I agree. And I look forward to when this is all edited together to being on some shitty list. So
Me too.